class of functions, which are writable as iterated integrals of a special form, and then abstract the information that is needed into a, distill that information into a some algebraic data that we're going to manipulate. And the last lecture may have been a bit theoretical, so we're going to try to see how to put that to some use today. And I think I promised you to do the path independence, but I decided to skip that for now. I'm going to hopefully come back to it and start with functional equations. Okay, so the logarithm is really the simplest function in this class of functions we've been discussing. And everybody knows that the logarithms satisfy this simple identity. Now, I'm not going to be worried about branch cuts and all that for now. And the question is, what about the rest of the functions that we defined, or the functions in this class of functions? So we have identities. I'm just going to start by listing some identities. Identities in one variable, and let me start with the die logarithm case. So these are well-known identities. They've been known for a long time, classical identities. And for the tri logarithm, we have something more complicated. I'm going to write part of it. Plus some other simpler terms there. I'm not going to write down. And there's a general formula, still a one variable identity, but an identity called an inversion. Which is the generalization of this one to arbitrary transcendentality. So this is for transcendentality 2. A similar identity holds so the right hand side. I'm going to write it explicitly, but it's not very important. These are Bernoulli numbers. which are some rational numbers that appear now and then. So one remark I should make here, if we're going to attempt to prove such identities by using the notion of symbol I introduced last time. And one important point is that very often such identities contain terms like this or like this, where k is different from zero. And when we take the symbol of such objects, we're going to get zero. So just by using the information we have in the symbol, we're not going to be able to detect such kind of terms in the identities we're going to consider. And that's not surprising, because there is some information that we're missing when we restrict to the symbol, right? We haven't fixed, for example, the beginning of the path of the integration. We're considering the function as a function of the endpoint of the path. And then, of course, there are at most countable number of choices of what path you're going to take. So we're losing some information. But the main point is that the most complicated part of these identities, the one not containing any pi's or zetas or anything like that, is going to be really what we're going to get. So we're missing some pieces, but it's not too bad. And anyway, those pieces we can attempt to fix by other means. And I'm going to try to give an example also of how this works. Okay. There's some other identity which is a bit strange. But less useful. So these are pretty much all the identities, all the simple identities in one variable. So one thing to notice here is that there is one identity, the inversion identity, that works for arbitrary transcendentality. But, for example, this one doesn't really extend to higher transcendentality. There is some sort of analog for Li 3s. Okay, so let's do a simple example. Last time I told you that this is something we saw last time. And just by simple algebraic manipulations, just by using the two properties that I wrote for you on the blackboard, this factorization property and the the fact that if a number appears in one of these entries, then we get zero. It's not so hard to show that this is equal to okay, so this should be easy to show. And then let me write it here. And then this is the same as the symbol of minus. So remember that and so we immediately recognize here a symmetric product, this and this. And in general, that can immediately be identified with logs. And here we recognize symbols of dilogs, this and this. Now, there is actually, in this case, there is a more or less systematic way of doing this, but you can look at the symmetric and anti-symmetric part. And the anti-symmetric part is going to contribute to that's right. I'm coming back to that in a minute. So a transcendentality 2 symmetric part anti-symmetric part is always writable in terms of this combination, which is called the Rogers function. So you can split it into pieces and then look at them separately, and then they don't mix. Now, there's Here, you could have done this in other ways. This is not the only way to do it. And the reason I did it this way is because if you look here carefully, every term has a regular expansion around zero. Series expansion. And that's also true for this term. Right, so I could have chosen a, there are several ways of rearranging things, but the preferred one is the one where the terms have a regular series expansion around zero, just like the initial function. Okay, so what we can do now is to just compare the series expansion. And, well, another argument, of course, it's not so trivial to compute the expansion to all order for some of these functions. But a simpler argument is to just say that the difference between this function and this function has to be something which vanishes, whose symbol vanishes. So it must contain factors of pi and such things. But on the other hand, the series expansion of this and this have rational coefficients. Okay? And in general, the series expansion of this transcendental function is, if it's regular, it has rational coefficients. So there's no way to have anything else with pi's. So that means this is the whole answer. This is something that may not always apply, but it applies in this case. So we get that, we get an identity. Okay, so this is an example of what you can do with the symbol. We've reduced the problem of proving such identities or even finding such identities to a problem in algebraic manipulations. We need to take a look at combination of this sort and put them in a certain form. Okay, so far, this is the only example with two variables I discussed. Right, so you mean the dialogue identity, right, that I wrote down. Okay, let's do that one. So, actually, let's do the one for arbitrary transcendentality. Okay, so we have this combination. And let's take the symbol. This is minus 1 minus z. And here, we have n minus 1 terms. Okay. Now, recall that 1 over z, I can transform into a z, but I have to pull out a minus sign. Right? So, this can be written as, so I have n minus 1 minus signs and the 1 minus sign from here, so this is going to cancel. So I get a plus 1. Now, I can put this minus sign inside here and replace this 1 minus z by 1 over 1 minus z, right? And since these last terms are identical in the two cases, I can combine them instead of expanding them as before. So I get this. Now, this 1 over z, I can transform it in a z if I pull out the minus sign. So it's just going to be z n times. Yes. Oh, so you're worried about the minus sign, right? Okay, sorry. So there's a minus sign here. But the minus sign, thank you. So here I had 1 minus 1 over z, and here I wrote 1 minus z divided by z. But in fact, I should have written z minus 1 divided by z, and then what happens is that this minus sign actually doesn't do anything. I can just erase it. Just by the property that I can factor things, and then if I get a number, then its contribution is going to be zero. So in this case, I would factor out minus one. Right? And then it's an easy exercise to show that this is the symbol of one over n factorial log x power n, log z power n. Okay, so if you go back to the equation I wrote for you, this should be what you get, but I hope it's right. Of course, we're not getting the terms with pi, but Here, if you study the monodromies of these poilogs, which I don't know if I'm going to get to discuss, you can actually get those too. So it's not a big problem. Okay, now I'm going to show you a famous identity. Which is the five-term dialogue identity. And this is an identity in two variables, which goes back a long time to Abel, Spence, Kummer, and a lot of other people. So this identity actually has a Z5 symmetry, which is not obvious in the usual way of writing it, but I'm going to try to make it obvious here. And for that, I'm going to define a sequence by this recursion relation. And you can show that this is periodic with period 5. You should try it as an exercise. It's not so hard to show. But it's surprising. I mean, if you look at this, it doesn't immediately, it's not immediately clear why that happens. Okay, so now let's compute the symbol of this following combination. Let me see. I call this N. A N. So this is easy. Now let's use this identity. Okay, so here the periodicity, the period 5 is important. And that can be expanded. And now I'm going to make a change of variable in the first term. Shifted by 1, which I can do because this is periodic. And what do I find? I find a symmetric combination here. So this is a product of logarithms. Let me write it like this. Equals. So the symbol of this combination of dialogues and plus this combination of logs is zero. So that's all you can say, all we can say using symbols, but it turns out that's pretty much the whole story, because the complete identity is that is pi squared over 6. So it's a constant. The usual way of writing is obtained if we put A1 equals X, A2 equals, well, there are several ways of writing the five-term identity, but this is one of the familiar ones. Of course, more complicated things can be shown this way, but one thing I should say here before we move on is that this five-term identity is essential for the die logarithms, in the sense that pretty much every other identity, every other die log identity can be shown starting from the five-term identity. So everything else is not independent. This is the only one you need, and this actually can be used to show the inversion formula and the 1 minus z related to z. The only identity you cannot show using this is the sort of the reality condition where you use complex conjugation of the argument. But the rest are there. I don't know. Did you check this? Okay, so I don't know. The constant cannot be obtained using symbols, but once you have this relation, I don't know, you can look at monodromies, or you can just, in this case, it's not so bad. In this case, you can just, I guess in this case, you can just try to set some of these. You have two parameters, so you can try to set them to be just have one function of one variable somehow, and or you can just evaluate it, you know, at a certain number of points. You you definitely need to evaluate it at least at one point, because there's a constant of integration which you cannot cannot find otherwise. But the main point here is that the most complicated part of the identity is this. Then you have constants or things like that. They're necessarily simpler functions because they're of lower transcendentality. So you've still made some progress in understanding the relations. Okay, so maybe I should go back now and discuss a bit the path independence. This here. So recall from last time that the symbol of a product is a shuffled product, right? So here we have a shuffled product of n different things. So because they only have one single element, this just becomes all the permutations. So that's the origin of this factor of 1 over n factorial here. Otherwise, you would get n factorial terms from expanding this. Yeah, the other ones you can't get this way. Right, so the other ones, the ones that come multiplied with pi's or zetas or such transcendental constants, you can't say anything about them at this stage using only this kind of thing. You can say things about them if you look at monodromies. So you look at discontinuities across branch cuts and things like that. Okay, so actually, let's go to path independence. This is an important part which I skipped because I wanted to get to some applications. So remember that the functions we were considering were functions such that they were really independent of local deformations of the path. So what constraints does that impose on the differential forms that appear in this iterated integral writing of these functions? So let's start with a simple example. So what is the condition for this to be independent of the path? We need this form to be closed. So let's look at a simple example. Now, if I pick a domain around this path here, then this form is closed on that domain. So I can just deform the path a little bit, and the result of the integral is going to be the same. Now, I can also do, I can take a path through here. And of course, when I deform this path onto this path, then I'm going to pick up a residue. So under this large deformation of the path, I'm not getting the same result, but something which includes the contribution of this residue. And then I can take other paths. But the point here is that there's a at most countable number of choices that I have. So this local path independence, which holds under this condition, actually produces for me a multi-valued function. Let's do an example with two differential forms. Okay, so let me define. Function f. This would be a partial integral along this path up to a point. And in fact, this integral is just going to become times this time, w2. So remember, this is a notation for I'm integrating this up to a certain point, and then I'm multiplying by this differential form evaluated at that point, and then I'm integrating everything again on the path. So this is just a consequence of the definition of this operation. But now we have just a simple integral like before. So the condition is the same. Okay. Now df is w1. So this implies w1 wedge w2 equals 0. So only when these two differential forms satisfy this condition, only then is this integral invariant with respect to small changes of the path. And this is an integrability condition. Let me do a slightly more general example. Sorry? I can. Yes, yes. Yes. I'm assuming all of them are closed. This is actually the situation we're in, because what we have is that these objects here are actually D log of something. So they're even exact, except maybe where they have poles. So a slightly more general example is the case of a sum. And here really the same thing applies, and the conditions, so again, integrability condition here is going to be this. So the main message here is that not every symbol you can write down corresponds to a function, a multi-valued function. If you try to, if you just take a random symbol, which is not integrable, and you try to integrate it along different paths, then you're going to get different answers. So that, different answers, and that doesn't really define a function, not even a multi-valued function. So this means that, well, this is a check on the kind of symbols we consider. And I'm going to do an example for you now. Favorite example is the Li 1,1 example. Now the symbol of that is remind you. Okay, so we're in this situation here. We have a sum with three terms, and our differential forms are actually d log of these objects here. Right, so let's compute what we need to compute is this. Do I have enough space here? Okay, let's do it. now I can cancel some terms. This term cancels because it's wedged with the x. And here, this term cancels because it's wedged with dy. Okay, where can I do this here? So I'm going to get dx, dy, and with a minus sign x. Plus and plus no, this is a minus here. Sorry. Minus. Okay, this has to be zero. And here, let me see. Yeah, I think that's a plus. Yeah, thank you. So here, actually, that was crucial. So, well, let's see. Minus x, 1 minus y, plus. Sorry? Well, I'm almost done. 1 minus x. And I think it's working. It's zero. But you see here, it was really non-trivial. It gets contributions from everything. So okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so pretty much the same thing works. I'm actually hesitating whether I should write the condition for the transcendentality higher than 2. But yes, you can do it if you just know these differential forms, you can just check. And it's not, it basically involves these two neighboring differential forms at a time. There are some a bit more complicated cases, but that's not something that really arises in the context I'm discussing things here. Okay, so the main message here is that whereas to a function of a special type, you can always associate the symbol. It's not always true that to just any given random symbol, you can associate a function. The dialogue? The dialogue is trivial because you're going to have to check this. Yes. Yes. I'm not sure I understand. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, in that case, that's why I didn't give you that example, because it was too easy to check. I mean, it's just a trivial check. Okay. They depend on the, so remember that these are differential forms on a manifold. So they really depend on all the coordinates on this manifold. Here you should think of them as, otherwise this would really be trivial every time, because if you think of them as the pullback, then they're function of one variable, right? So in that case, this condition would be completely empty. But you should really think of them as differential forms living on this manifold. Right. Yeah, sorry, that wasn't clear. Okay, so maybe I have 15 minutes? Yeah. So, well, probably the best thing to do now, there's a very cute geometrical interpretation of the dialogue algorithms, which I can't resist talking about. So this has to do with volumes of ideal tetrahedron. In hyperbolic space. So what we have is a three-dimensional hyperbolic space with a boundary here, which is C and the point at infinity, which is a three-dimensional hyperbolic space with a two-dimensional boundary. And I have the geodesics are demi-circles in vertical planes. So I'm considering this sort of in a Poincaré coordinate system. And so let me write this. And geodesic planes are hemispheres. Ending on the boundary. And so We can build tetrahedra such that their edges are geodesics and their faces are geodesic planes. So such a tetrahedron would look something sort of like this. So the four vertices lie on the boundary, and that's why it's called ideal. And the question now is, what is the volume of such an object? And the volume is finite, and it was computed by Lobachevsky long time ago. And the answer is, expressed like this. So suppose the vertices are described by some complex numbers, then I can build a cross ratio. And the volume is going to be the function d2 of this cross ratio, where d2 is the imaginary part of the dialogue . So this is a real analytic function. It's a function from C to R, and it's analytic. And it has some simple properties. It's so this is the Bloch-Wigner function. It has some simple properties. When evaluated in 0, 1, and infinity, it's 0. And actually, that's when, if the cross ratio takes values 0, 1, and infinity, then this 4 points degenerate into 3 points. So the whole tetrahedron degenerates, so the volume is 0. This is not surprising. Then we have this property. So if sigma is a permutation of the 4 points, then this volume picks up a sign. So when the orientation changes, then there's a sign difference. And actually, from this, you can show that if you recall, this is sort of the kind of identities that we had for the dialogue, except that this time we don't have extra terms. So that's an advantage of this function. It satisfies simpler functional identities than the dialogue. And finally, suppose you pick a configuration of 4 points and you compute the cross ratio and then you start permuting them. You permute the points, then the value of the cross ratio is going to be, you know, z, 1 minus z, 1 over z, 1 minus 1 over z, such things. So you have 6 kind of possibilities. It's just pick 4 points, take their cross ratio, then if you permute them, you're going to see that the cross ratio of the permuted points are actually not independent of the initial cross ratio of the initial points, but they're related in a simple way like that. Yes, yes, that's what I'm telling you. This identity is really the same as this. For some values of the cross ratios. Okay, so the last property so if I have 5 points this time, and I take the cross ratios of 4 at a time, so this hat here means missing argument, I compute function d2 of that argument, and then I combine them together with signs, then I get 0. Now, this is actually a very nice, has a very nice geometric interpretation. So I'm going to draw the tetrahedron now in a, with straight edges, not like there, because otherwise it would be harder to draw. So the interpretation of this identity here is that if I take 5 points, and then I take all the tetrahedra I can make out of 4 points at the time, I'm going to get 5 tetrahedra because I'm always leaving 1 point out, and their volumes are actually in an algebraic relation to one another. For example, if this point is an interior, then the sum of the volumes of this tetrahedra is the volume of the whole thing. So this tells you that when you include orientation and everything, it tells you that you can triangulate a tetrahedron, and then the volume of the tetrahedron is the volume of the pieces in which you triangulated. Now, this story doesn't really have an extension to higher polylogs, but I thought it's a nice example to show you. Sorry? Yeah, well, there are other polylogs with which admit geometric interpretations, but this is really the most striking example I know. So the other ones are more complicated. And if you think about it, it's really not so easy to come up with such a thing. I mean, you have to think about having ideal tetrahedra in hyperbolic space. Okay, it's not the first thing that you think about when you want to find the geometric interpretation of these five-term relations, for example. Okay. Oh, the symbol of D2. Okay, now, this is... It doesn't really have a symbol in the traditional sense, in the sense that, you see, I have an imaginary part of a dialogue in there, and then I have arguments. The argument, I erased it, oh, it's here. This argument could sort of be written as some logarithm in the end, but I think it's less natural to associate a symbol to it. It's not really a complex analytic function. It's just a real analytic function. So, yeah, in this case, it's not... that's right. That's right. You could define it as a function of two variables, and then you can do it. But yeah.
Is this by the
previous? Yes, it's yeah, that's right. This is basically the five-term dialogue identity. Right. I think I'm done. Can't start any.
Any more questions for Christian? If not, let's thank the speaker again. And we'll meet back here in half an hour.